This is tape two, side one of the interview with Mr. Roger Hurl on January 29, 1999.
I'm kind of circling the wagons each time I'm talking about this, but we go from our ability to conform to regulation in the future and that kind of thing to the development of better science to create better products and so forth to the ugly economic realities of an industry within a broad array of industries and the need to be a more stable, a more higher return industry in total to attract capital and equity.
Do you find that the stockholders are more demanding for these types of changes in perspective early on in your career?
Definitely. No question about it. Whether they be, you can take the array of shareholder groups from those who exert the regulatory pressure on us to say, you know, we shouldn't be making these products, or, you know, and there are a number of shareholder groups out there from religious ethicists to environmentalists to you name it, on that side of it, to people who are purely looking at the return to the shareholder, but let's say economic value added or an industry. And you're sitting there with an array of industries and you've got an investing public and you say, which industry should I invest in? Stay away from the chemical industry. It's too damn cyclical and their returns are low, and you know, there are specific companies that might look good today, but it's not an industry that if you're looking for deep value or long-term growth and so forth, that's not an industry to put your money in. Not something we want. It's kind of like being the steel industry of the next millennium. We don't want to do that.
You made reference just a moment ago to the financial crisis in Asia. Occidental Chemical has a number of Asian installations, doesn't it?
We have an aggregate seven, of which only two are wholly owned. The others are joint ventures. They're in generally in the vinyl and chloralkali and in the phenolic resins business. We have a couple of investments in what we call DeRes, phenolic resins and molding compounds. It's hard to describe what has happened when I've talked to my peers who have justified their investments and so forth. And we've all read all the papers and all read all the reasons for lack of transparency in the investing between banks and companies and on. It's hard to describe. It's really hard for me to describe what it is that has happened any more than it is for me to read what has happened to somebody who really knows what's going on.
Do you have any speculation about the future for Occidental's Asian investments and plants?
Well, the plants that we have, Jim, we have no desire to get out of them. We put the investment on the ground. They're not returning anything of significance, certainly returning investment on a cash basis, but not on a full investment basis, just like many others aren't. Recently, within the last 6 months, I read, and read forever, but saw an analysis of a projection by several agencies, including Deutsche Bank, Technon, a few others who are, I think, considered knowledgeable people in forecasting economics, as to the number of years that they perceived it would take for various countries within the Southeast Asian region to recover to a consumption level equal to their consumption in the fourth quarter of 1997. And that ranged from 2.5 to 5 years, with the average being about 3.5 years. Altogether, with some signs of recovery beginning in 2000, I guess, was generally the perception that you really began to see something from going from negative to positive. But reading that in depth and taking that against other things I've read, I tend to feel that that probably is the most intelligent assessment that I've seen of what will happen over there. But because it was based on events that have to occur in each of these countries in order for that to happen, and as you read and hear about what is being done, it tends to follow with the actions being taken in those countries, social, political, cultural, economic, and so forth. But that's a long time.
Are the Asian plants producing same products that U.S. plants are producing, are there productions that are unique to the Asian market?
They are the same, fundamentally the same products that are produced here, and one of the things that one has to face is that they're, I want to make sure we understand, landed costs, meaning their input costs may be higher, but if you eliminate the transportation costs, landing a product on a particular, at a particular consuming point, their landed costs are, would be about the same, but their efficiencies are higher, because we're talking about plants that are 1 to 3 years old, so they're using the most efficient technology generally. I've got some side things to that I really don't want to talk about, but so you, you know, in an obscure way, you're looking at what happened to Europe once they recovered, and Japan, as they recovered from the Second World War. All of what is there in the way of capital investment is newer on average than those facilities that, that we compete with globally. And we've had a rapid buildup of, for example, of chlor-alkali capacity on the Gulf Coast for the first time in many years. Those plants on a cash cost basis are very low cost because they're all the most modern, efficient technologies and so forth. If you load in the return on investment, then we can compare with older facilities because we're depreciated in this facility. But the point is, they can operate on a cash basis, cash on cash basis, at a lower cost than the U.S. producing facilities. And if all you're interested in making a cash on cash return, they're very efficient and very competitive.
Well, your activities in Occidental Chemical and chemical industry in general led to your selection as the award recipient of the SCI Medal in 1997. Could you discuss a little bit of about the award, the citation, its implications, and what the event meant to you?
Well, several people have said to me, I may or may not leave this in the interview, but why the hell didn't you retire? while 97 wasn't this most sparkling year we've had as a company and so forth, but if you take an A or get 95, 96, and 97, averaging those 3 years, very, very good years economically, and very, everything was going well and so forth, and here you have a medal recognizing you, SCI and so forth. I guess what I'm really saying is, yeah, that was a unique honor, which I'm very proud of. I guess it meant to me that the investment that I've made in industry associations and working within the industry to honestly try to improve its credibility and its posture and stature in the U.S. and the world and as an industry, I felt like it was something that I was very proud of, and I appreciated the recognition. As you look, one of the things that I looked at was who preceded me with those medals, and that's a rather awesome group of people who have received that, as well as the Perkin Medal. So it is something that I will consider the highest honor I've received in the time I've been associated with the industry, and I'm deeply proud of it. And, let's say, humble to the extent of knowing there were others equally as deserving of the award, but I'm very much pushing it, very much.
On the occasion of your receipt of that medal, what was the emphasis in your award address?
Well, I tried to do it differently than Keith McKenna. And I used Keith's comment. Keith McKenna was Dow Corning chairman at the time. And I've kept the analysis that was done in, I think it was in the Chemical Engineering News, related his speech, and I think it was something to the extent I'm proud to be a member of an industry that has more, done more good for more people in the world than any other period. And I knew Keith well at the time, and I very much admired him, but it was an attempt to say, let's focus on the things we've done well. Let's concern ourselves with the things that we need to do, but let's think about the things we've done well and take as much pride as possible in the industry as such. And while we think in terms of what we have to do and the things we need to do in responsible care and all these regulatory areas, let's also think about what good this industry has done for the public at large and so forth, and try to get some more positive balance in what we have accomplished versus what people think we are doing that's bad. And, I think I did at that time relate to the Love Canal era and how I felt about the people who were involved in about Pinnell and why they were people who were doing the right thing and the best way they knew how at the time, and we still are. But that was my intent, was to focus on the positive, recognizing our responsibilities in dealing with the detractors.
One of the things you did not touch on, recall just thinking back over what you said, is what prompted the move from Houston to Dallas, the company when you...
Well, we moved from Houston to Connecticut, Jim, and then back to Dallas. What prompted the move to Dallas was Occidental's acquisition of Diamond Shamrock Chemicals, who were headquartered here. We had a very small staff in Connecticut because the core of management was diverse. We had three operating units in Tampa, Philadelphia, and one up in Niagara Falls. So we were really a true core kind of a holding company situation. Diamond Shamrock, with all of their plants located on the Gulf Coast and so forth, and their headquarters here, they had about 350 people here who managed the operation in depth. And it was clear that the logical place to be from the standpoint of where our asset mix would be, and was a little bit, but far more, as with the Diamond Shamrock, the logical place to be was here. So we moved here in short order. I have my favorite Dallas story. The people who worked for me in Connecticut, if they were to go to Houston, Texas, they would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and fight the traffic to go to LaGuardia Airport, go through all the machinations of dealing with a typical New York crowd and all that kind of thing, and end up in Houston at for lunch. If you live in Dallas, you leave the office at 10:30, get on a plane at 11 o'clock, and you're at lunch. Now that's a appraisal of what reality is in so far as productivity is concerned. It just so happens that Dallas is here, but it's a much, much better headquarters location than the East Coast for a company like ours in particular. So if, I guess, put it another way, if Diamond Shamrock were not in Dallas, we would have moved to Houston. Because Houston is truly the center of the chemical industry, geographically and asset-wise. Nearly 70%, maybe even a little bit more, of our capital investment is on the Gulf Coast, from Louisiana down through Texas, and that implies a lot. So, very logical place to be. It was no small value to me personally, since my family lives in Dallas and Houston, and I have 10 grandchildren, and it's kind of nice to be here from a standpoint of a personal situation, too. And we are a very family-oriented group, a very close family.
The SCI Medal has won award, and you indicated significant it is to you. But I've noted from reading that you've gotten at least a couple of honorary degrees from institutions, Canisius College and St. John's.
Mm-hmm.
How did you happen to be recognized by those institutions particularly?
Well, it in the case of Canisius, Occidental supported a lot of activities in Canisius and Buckwell. A number of employees that were graduates of Canisius. We supported a lot of educational activities at Canisius College. And I think I will say that the Canisius College Award was more a case of what I did for Western New York in dealing with the issue of Love Canal. Because there was a stigma attached to Western New York also as a result of this. And I think by burying, if you will, the stigma of Love Canal, that Canisius chose to recognize me as somebody who put the environment and people and things like that ahead of necessarily a bottom line profitability, which is true. I won't say ahead of it, but an equal footing with it, and that was that. The other one was somewhat for the same reason, quite frankly. The president of St. John's University was for a number of years the president of Niagara University on the Western New York area. And we had some very, very involved dealings with Niagara University on the same basis, but even more in depth, because some of the environmental areas that Occidental was involved in were adjacent to the Niagara University campus and so forth. So again, I think it's a case of solving the dilemma of the stigmas that were attached to that region, and even to the college itself was pretty much at the bottom of it. But it came from St. John's because the president, who I became a very good friend of and still am, chose to give me the honor when he moved to St. John's. And I still personally, as well as the corporation, provides funds to St. John's Street College. It has the largest pharmacology college in the United States. I never knew that until I found a little bit more about it. But it's, and, you know, I'm a Roman Catholic. I call myself a religious man. I don't care. Maybe this would not be on the tape, but my life principles are very much on the line of family and moral light and so forth, which we're going to talk about Bill Clinton. We can talk the rest of the day about that. We'll leave that alone. But a friendship and a relationship and wanting to see a region that I think unfairly have been stigmatized, see the stigma basically removed.
You have made reference to your family members along the way as we talked this morning, but I'd invite you to focus on it right now to give a rundown on your family, your children, and so forth.
Well, I have four children. My oldest son, who recruited me to Oxy, we have a family joke about that because he had worked for Oxy for, by the time I joined them, he had worked for Oxy for about 11 years in their transportation and energy marketing, what they called Oxy Crude Sales in Houston. And excuse me, I left them about 3 years ago, went into business for himself. He's, along with some investors, making a couple of products that are in electronic areas, and I don't think of the name of it. It's something that you can set up your television set to allow only certain channels to be watched and so forth. And also as a consultant in the energy industry with Bankers Trust and a couple of others. My daughter, who is the second one, is lives in Dallas. Her husband is with Texas Instruments, and he's involved in materials management and in this information technology development with them. His famous SAP information process, he does work on that as well as in materials management. Number three is a son who works for Oxy Kim. He's in the engineering group. He works with the engineering and multiple plants down there in information processing and information technology section. My youngest son is living here in Dallas. He's actually now not working. He has a disease of the eyes called retinitis pigmentosa and is legally blind. So he's doing some work with the computer access, doing some things with the Nations Bank, which they've allowed him to do because he was working for them at the time. But he lives here, and that's the family, and I said we have 10 grandchildren, so a very active life, and everybody's healthy and everybody's doing well. So a happy father and grandfather, put it that way.
How many grandchildren?
10.
10 grandchildren.
I've given them, my children, all the admonitions that anyone does as their family develops that rapidly, but that's sort of the way it is. Eight granddaughters and two grandsons.
Are you and your wife experiencing the emptiness syndrome since you had four children to rear and they departed for their own family situation?
But let me put it this way, Jim, for the let's say the 2 weeks of the Christmas holidays, we had something between 12 and 20 people in our house. So the emptiness syndrome is not a problem. We have the three grandchildren, daughter and son who live here, so we spend as much time with the family as is appropriate. We're a very close family, and our children used to come up with some regularity, so no emptiness syndrome.
I noticed from some accounts of your activities that you associated with some, I guess one would call volunteer activities in Dallas. Can you speak something about your involvement there?
Well, I've been on the board of the Twitching Wood, which is a broad activity on the board and the executive committee of the Dallas Citizens Council, which is a more focused, proactive organization dealing with what I would call more macro issues in the city, including public education and public utilities. Development of various and sundry areas, low-income areas and so forth, and the Dallas Together Forum, which is a branch of that, dealing with diversity and those kind of things. I'm very involved in what is technically called the Southwestern Museum of Science and Technology, or the Science Place. And that ties together my very strong dedication to science education, as well as just education in general. It's, I've been personally very active and on the board, vice chairman of that, and while my day job has caused me a problem in spending as much time as I used to, and it's still very actively involved on the board of the Science Place. I'm on the board here. That's hardly considered a civic activity. We involve ourselves as a company in basically educational areas. One of the things that I say somewhat proud of is that we have been for 7 years have provided housing and furniture and everything else for the Susan Komen Foundation, the Breast Cancer Foundation. Somebody said, why are you interested in that? I said, well, I have 8 granddaughters and a daughter and a wife and 2 daughters-in-law. I'm very interested in research in that, and I'm trying to think of other things. Off and on, there have been a number of other civic activities. But
the Breast Cancer Foundation has given you an award, I believe.
Yes, a humanitarian award. My wife is very involved in it, and we personally support it as well as the company does. I try not to take advantage of the corporation's involvement for personal benefit, but we do a lot of it work personally with the organization as she does, and I do to some extent. But education foremost, and science and helping is the being secondary, but very important.
Your own career in the industry was immediately preceded by liberal studies degree, mm-hmm. Which is not the usual preparation for a chemical industry executive. Mm-hmm. Have you had the feeling that unusual preparation advantaged you or disadvantaged you, or was more neutral?
That's a little hard to answer, Jim, in that let me answer that in 2 ways. One, I think it gave me a broader interest as I looked at my future than to focus solely on, I'll say, chemical engineering or niche chemistry, so that while I respect the fact that these are very vital functions, to get focused to that, I probably wasn't prepared to, I'll say, be more narrow in my view of what my future was. And for that reason, I think it was a benefit to broaden the horizons and get involved in many other activities, including all the things I talked about with legal and things like that. On the other hand, there are times when I'll call a lack of deep knowledge of chemistry. I wonder sometimes whether I'm able to direct resources adequately without that fundamental knowledge of chemistry that sometimes is helpful in making decisions. But when you get to the place where I am and have been prior to this on a couple of occasions, you pretty much rely on the resources of other people. I've had maybe 2 or 3 times in my career here, people ask the question about how do you get the management of an oil company to understand the chemical industry? And I said, well, let's take the chairman, who is a PhD chemist and has 150 patents worldwide, and the president, who is a PhD chemical engineer. It's not hard to explain to them the chemical business. But since, as I said, we are not a scientifically technology research-oriented company in our businesses, I don't consider it a detriment. I am the gentleman who is leading our specialty chemical development, chemical intermediates development. Since my staff, let's say half of a staff of 10 people, have chemical education backgrounds, the other half have virtually none. So, starting back about 1.5 years ago, every other monthly management meeting, I had to do a chemistry lesson for us, and the products that we make, and the technology and process behind it. And I know several times we'd be sitting there talking about something, and I would answer a question. How'd you know that? So, well, perhaps the lack of that education has caused me to dig deeper into what's going on here than maybe the average person was, because I don't want to be in a position where I don't understand what's going on. So if we're going to make I don't know how the hell we make it, what the molecules look like, and so forth. And I do understand chemistry. I studied a lot of it. But to the extent it's possible, I always try to get a little bit behind it and understand what's going on out there. Sometimes surprises people, but maybe it's case of I'm not going to get caught not knowing anything about what's going on in the books.
As you think back over our conversation, do you think of anything else that you would like to add or expand on for completeness of the story?
Jim, without being able to obviously recount everything I've said, perhaps not, but if I could emphasize one thing over the other in my view of where the future of this industry, where we perhaps need to put more intellectual investment, more practical investment and so forth, it goes back to the attraction of capital, the attraction of equity, the attraction of intellectual capital. I have 10 grandchildren, and would I recommend to them that they pursue chemistry, chemical engineering, career in the chemical industry? I don't know the answer to that, and I should. And I should be able to say, this is a great field for young people. That's it. That's as a little bit of a distraction from what I talked about in attracting capital and attracting investment. I think we should focus on attracting intellectual capital, getting the hearts and minds of young people. It's a little bit in a silly way, like, why don't we have enough priests out there? We can't attract young people to get into the religious professions. What are we doing about attracting people to join the chemical industry and the scientific disciplines of chemistry and chemical engineering and get into the chemical industry? We need to really give some very serious thought into how we portray ourselves as companies and as industries to attract the hearts and minds of young people into this profession. We're number two producer in the world of chlorine and caustic. To attract even a person already in the chemical engineering field to this particular business is not easy. And as we lose those who have an in-depth knowledge of this business and industry and so forth, increasingly we find ourselves sort of short of the talent we need in the future. So along with attracting dollars of capital, we need to work very hard to create or develop or continue an environment that attracts young people to this industry. Recruiting on campuses and competing with Amazon.com isn't easy. And perhaps that's not necessary as much.